Hello and welcome to Immigrantly. I am Sadia Khan, your host. Some days it feels like I'm carrying the weight of the world on my shoulders. And today is one of those days. Mentally and emotionally, I'm exhausted. Honestly, my body is starting to feel the toll of all the negativity and misinformation swirling around immigrants right now. And what truly frustrates me is the hypocrisy. People who have benefited from immigrant communities trashing them now? Seriously? I mean, come on, guys. Look at Marco Rubio, whose parents were Cuban immigrants, yet he's complicit in policies that make life harder for today's immigrants. Or Stephen Miller, whose family fled persecution, but has been the architect of some of the most anti-immigrant policies we've seen. It's heartbreaking. It truly is. But today, I want to hit pause on all that negativity. Instead, I want us, you and I, to turn back time and celebrate the legacy of immigrants who've helped build this country, who've brought so much joy, texture, meaning to what it means to be an American. Today, I am talking to Nancy Wong. She is an author, storyteller, and artist. Her book, Red Altar, explores the incredible story of her ancestors who were pioneers in California's fishing industry. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Chinese immigrants established fishing villages along the California coast. They innovated commercial fishing with techniques like using fire baskets to attract squid at night because they weren't allowed to fish during the day, laying the foundation for what would become a thriving fishing industry in Monterey Bay. Despite facing systemic racism and exclusionary laws, their persistence left a legacy that shaped the region and beyond. Nancy's work brings this rich, often overlooked history to light. And I'm so glad that we are sharing this story on Immigrantly in this moment, right at this time. So let's dive into her story, her writing process, and untold histories that continue to shape our nation. Finally, we had some logistical issues, which is fine. It happens. But I'm so glad that we are here in this space. Thank you for being with me, Nancy. And it's 8:45 your time, which is early for me. I normally don't schedule anything before 10 a.m. So how are you feeling?
I'm okay now. It was a little crazy with the technology.
So you're based where?
We're in San Francisco.
How's the weather?
It's gorgeous. It was like 60 and sunny. Yeah, quite lovely.
I feel like in San Francisco, it's always 60 and sunny. I've been there twice and I love it. I love the city. I love the weather. But it's so far from New York.
It is.
It's a long flight.
It's a 5 hours at least.
Almost six, yeah.
Wow, that is long. We often want to go to New York. We go, so far away.
I know. It's like going to Europe for us. I could go to Europe, right?
Probably quicker.
Quicker. Yeah. So your book, Red Altar.
Yes, my book, Red Altar.
Why historical fiction?
You know, it's about my ancestors who started the fishing industry in 1850. So I have information about who they were, about the different generations. I know about what happened, where it happened. I know the environment, the racism, and the laws that were made against the Chinese all during that era in the late 1800s into the 1900s. But I don't know any of them. Right? So it's real people, real situations, real events, but I've had to kind of enhance their conversation, who they were, what kind of people they were, what their personalities were. So that becomes the fiction.
So talk to me about the story. It starts in mid-1800s, right? Let's go back in time.
So in 1850, my great-great-grandparents were on a junk boat with four other teenagers. They were like maybe 17, 18 years old. And they crossed from China all the way over to California in 1850. But it was a huge storm. They meant to go to San Francisco, but instead, they crashed into Carmel Bay because they had been pushed all the way down to Mexico. They fought their way back against the winds, against the tide, and they crashed. And when they were rescued by the Rumsean Indian peoples, and when they were nursed back to health and they finally were able to stand up and look around, they went, oh my goodness, all this water and not a single boat in the bay or beyond in the ocean. So they thought, why go to San Francisco? Here we have no competition. We can just start the whole industry here. So that's what happened.
And they were just teenagers.
They were just teenagers.
Oh my gosh. I don't even remember what I was doing as a teenager. They were quite enterprising for that age.
Courageous too.
And courageous. Yes, yes. Oh my gosh. What a journey.
So the book starts with the crash and then it goes back to when my great-grandparents were young and met each other. It starts to talk about him and his getting married. He's about to open the door where her home was. And then it stops and he's nervous and he's so nervous. His eyes are down. His head is down. He sees her shoes and slowly he comes up and there she is. And then boom, it goes to her and what she was going through. How she had prepared her, you know, sewing all her own wedding outfit and how scared she was and how now she has to leave her own family and she's never done that and she's only 16, but that was even late for women to get married.
And she was in China.
They were both in China.
Oh, so they came together?
Yes, which is very unusual. And there was another couple on their junk boat and then two other separate men who... they're probably all cousins or at least lived in the same village. So then it goes through hers and she walks out the door. So they were from a fishing village in China. So they had grown up with fishing. So when they took that big launch out to the Americas, it was exactly what they wanted to do. They wanted to start a fishing something. They wanted to be able to start fishing and use their junk boat to bring dried fish back to China or sell it in San Francisco and beyond. But instead, they started it in the Carmel Bay and did the same thing.
You've talked about how they were maneuvering this new space where there was a lot of opportunity, but then they also faced challenges, right? Because we are talking about their migration to the U.S. against the backdrop of Homestead Act of 1862. And then we have the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. Tell me, how were they maneuvering all of that with, you know, this idea of creating life for themselves in a new place and yet facing discrimination, racism, xenophobia? What was that life like, and how do you depict that in your book?
So you can imagine that it was no different than it is today.
Isn't that sad, though?
Yeah, yeah. Being afraid, being determined, though, just sure that they needed to keep doing what they were doing, not letting them stop them, right? So, for example, they started the fishing industry, and one of the laws passed against them was the Chinese cannot fish during the day.
How did that impact them? Can you explain what it really meant?
Okay, so when you go fishing, I don't know if there are any fishing people out there, but the best time to fish is usually the morning, right? And you go out and you look for maybe where the school of fish is, because they're not everywhere in the ocean. They gather in schools in certain areas, but now they weren't allowed to do that.
So the law was deliberately harming them.
Oh, yes. By then, the Italians and the Portuguese had also come to the Carmel and Monterey Bay area. So, of course, there was more competition now because they were more white than the Chinese. They, of course, succeeded in creating this kind of, please pass this law. And they weren't allowed to either fish at the shore. So what do? They fished at night.
And how difficult was it to fish at night?
Well, because they were fishermen from China, they knew that they could fish for squid at night.
So they pivoted.
And each time another law was passed, they had to reinvent themselves. And exactly what you said, pivoted. They just went to something else then that worked. And then, of course, they would pass another law against that, because the whole point was to get rid of the Chinese. But the Chinese persisted.
PSA for anyone who rents. If you haven't heard of Built, you are about to thank me. Earning points on rent is now a reality when you pay your rent through Built. You don't even have to check with your landlord to start earning points that you can use toward flights, hotel stays, fitness classes, and even your next rent payment. Let me break it down for you. There's no cost to join Built, and as a member, you'll earn valuable points on rent and on your everyday spending. Built points can be transferred to your favorite hotels and airlines, and even the ones you haven't heard of. There are over 500 airlines and 700,000 hotels and properties around the world you can redeem your Built points toward. Points can also be redeemed towards a future rent payment and unique experiences that only Built members can access. How incredible is that? So, if you're not earning points on rent, my question is, why not? Start earning points on rent you're already paying by going to joinbuilt.com/immigrantly. That's joinbilt.com/immigrantly. Make sure to use our URL so they know we sent you. joinbuilt.com/immigrantly to start earning points on your rent payments today. Tell me, how did the Chinese Exclusion Act impact them?
Well, I don't, you know, because the unusual fact that, like, for example, two couples came And then before 1882, because of that, more came. And pretty soon, those kids grew up and they married and they had kids. So I don't think it impacted them that much because they began to have their own families. And prior to that, more came over knowing how successful they had become and how easy it was because they were the only ones. Pretty soon, there were three different Chinese villages in the Monterey Bay area.
Nancy, I was reading somewhere that in 1906, the village was burned down.
Oh, yes.
Do you address that in your book?
Absolutely. So what happened in 1906 was the San Francisco earthquake. Chinatown in San Francisco was destroyed, totally burnt down. So a lot of the Chinese who had maybe started in the fishing industry, but decided to go to San Francisco for something else, they all began to come back to the fishing village. And about 100, and probably friends of theirs, so people who had not been in the fishing industry in Monterey, they also came. So about 100 started coming back to Monterey, and that was just too much. The people said, it's bad enough who we have already, and 100 more? And so they'd all this time tried to get rid of the Chinese. So why not burn their village down? Because they had been doing it all over the West Coast, in Wyoming, in Washington, Oregon, all throughout California. That was one of the ways they got rid of the Chinese, by burning down their villages. They also would round them up in the middle of the night and chase them out, put them on a barge or a train just to get rid of them, and send them to San Francisco or maybe Sacramento, I don't know, but to get rid of like in Auburn, California, and Seattle, Washington, they did the same thing, Wyoming.
But Nancy, they survived. They thrived, right? You're here, which is indicative of how they were able to create a life beyond one generation, right?
Oh, I'm fifth generation.
You're fifth generation. Wow.
And we have now seven generations in our family.
Do you feel the burden of what your ancestors achieved and how it defines you? And by burden, I mean in a positive way.
Well, you know, I did not grow up knowing this history at all.
Why?
Because my great-grandmother was married off to someone in San Francisco. So my grandmother was born then in San Francisco, and then she was married off to someone in Chicago. And that is where my family rooted. So I had no idea. I don't think my mother even knew that much.
So how did you find out?
So by then, I had moved to California, San Francisco. My mother came out to visit, and she wanted to see her cousin, Aunt Mary. And so I didn't remember that I had an aunt here. I had not any contact.
Why did you move to California?
First of all, I got a job in Stockton, California. I have a master's in social work. And at that time, all the organizations that needed social workers would go to all the graduate schools and recruit. And I was recruited to Stockton, California. And after 2 years, I left there because my aim was always to come to San Francisco. And so I was living in San Francisco, working at Children's Hospital. So my mother came to visit. And she wanted to see her Aunt Mary.
And this was around what time?
This was maybe 1990-something. Yeah. And so what happened was, she said, oh, there's a family reunion. I would like to go. You want to go? So I drove her. I went, family reunion? Who? Family? So we went all the way to the family reunion, which was near San Jose, where people from the village now generations later had moved to Fremont and Fresno, and some stayed in Monterey or Salinas or, you know, around there, and they all gathered. And it was the first time I knew what this was. And all these people are my cousins, and I didn't know. So then, of course, I wanted to know everything. And my Aunt Mary had the opportunity to visit every summer back to Monterey, even though she was born in San Francisco. And so she got to hear all the stories from her grandmother, who was the second generation and knew her own mother. Her grandmother knew her mother, who had been the one that came over. So got all the stories. And so she told me all her stories. And there it went. So I first started this whole project as a performance. So the performance is a multimedia performance that also follows three generations. And my husband and I, we put it on, and it was just so well received. People crying, people so happy to know, because people know about the railroads, they know about the gold mines,
but not the fishing industry.
No. So we've performed it all over the country. And then I don't even remember why it said, let's make it some book. I don't remember that, but I just started writing. And there's the book.
I want to go back to when you discovered all this history, right? When it unraveled for you. Were there any surprises?
Well, the whole thing was a surprise. The whole thing, learning what they had to go through, that as immigrants, because everyone was an immigrant at that point. Everyone knew their immigration history in the 1800s. It was not removed like it is today. I never was taught Asian American history. When I went to school, there was no such thing as Asian American studies. So in my book, and there's so many more, but the few I have pictures of all the flyers and the posters of kicking the Chinese out. You know, a picture of Uncle Sam with his foot kicking a Chinese out, holding him by his hair and kicking him all the way out. There's one where they make Chinese look like rats or bats or octopus. I mean, just really degrading, very racist stuff. I didn't know that. So that was shocking. And then to think that they had to go through that and still not only survive, but thrive, so that I'm here. My gratitude was immense to know what went on in order for that to happen. But it's not over.
Exactly. Nancy, you talk about resilience, and I have this love-hate relationship with the term, because I feel it comes with a cost, and it really burdens people who are expected to be resilient, to bounce back, irrespective of the circumstances, right?
Yes.
What do you think your ancestors sacrificed to create the opportunities they did?
I think it's not that different than today. I think that they had not much time to enjoy life. They had to just be at task all the time. They had to work harder. They had to work from morning till dusk. I mean, it's not like they got to go watch a performance anywhere, right? I mean, they always celebrated Chinese New Year's, and it was big, but that was probably about it. You know, I think today even the Chinese are very task-oriented. And it's taken my generation, when I think about my brothers and my sisters and my cousins at this generation, we do go see shows. We get to watch movies. But even my mom, who was a fourth generation, hers was also very task. My father, very task-oriented. The only thing they seemed to go out to were when banquets were held in someone's honor, or someone died, or, you know, Chinese New Year's. But other than that, it was task-oriented. And, you know, television didn't come until 1950s. So my parents were already adults with kids before they even had that in the home. So I think the sacrifice is to enjoy life. You know, sacrifice, task, task, sacrifice to make sure the next generation gets to have a better life than theirs.
Let's see if your ancestor's story could be turned into a sensory experience, a sound, a smell, a taste, a texture. How would you describe it?
Well, you know, the smell of the sea. For example, when Kwok Moi is born, well, even her brother, Tuk Lee, who are two of the main second generation that I focus on, and his love for the sea, the smell. He loved to eat the crunchy eyeballs of the fish when Mama cooked the fish. It was his to have. And loving to be out on the sea. He got to go to school, you know. There was the mission schools. But he hated it. He learned a lot and he loved it, but he loved the sea more. At least that's my impression, because he became a very well-known fisherman who helped Stanford professors and scientists find a very elusive kind of eel fish, but the embryos, not the fish yet, but the embryos. So he was very good at it.
Such a remarkable story. What is your relationship with water, with sea?
My dad loved fishing, so we did go fishing. I was, you know, my father is not of, this is my mom's family, right? My father was from Shanghai, so he was a first generation. But he, I think all Chinese, wherever there's water, they go fishing. They love fish. That's the more natural food for Chinese to eat than like beef. He was a consul general from China. So he was stationed in New Orleans, which is why I was born in New Orleans. But there were a lot of actually Chinese in the South, which is why he was stationed in the South. But anyway, we would go crabbing. We would go on the bayous and crab. And he would always take us to Lake Michigan and fish. And so I knew about that. But as an adult, I didn't fish. And I still don't fish.
So you've covered five generations. If there were one person among your ancestors that you could have a conversation with, who and what would that conversation look like?
So it would be between So May, who was the one that came on the junk boat, and she had to have such courage to leave family because it was so unusual. You just didn't do that. You stayed home and you welcomed your husband back. You had their baby and then they go back. And then you'd raise your child by yourself in his family. And then he'd come back. I figured she was not about to do that, which is why she came. So I would want to talk to her about her courage and what it was like when she first got here. It was raw, what it was like for her to see these white people for the first time, or her daughter, Kwok Moi.
Why?
Because she got to be born here and run around. And she was a tomboy, was what my Aunt Mary said. So I imagined her running around and, you know, climbing on trees and then running over here. And she could speak five languages. So I would want to even talk to her because she became, at least in my imagination, very political with her brother. And they're the ones that tried to stop what was going on, to address what was going on with the villagers outside, you know, the Monterey people. They play very heavily in the book, you know, because they went through the 1906 burning of the village. And Tuk Lee, his house did not burn down. So he tried to keep going back to his house and they refused to let him. And so he finally climbed over a fence and he's apparently lived there amongst all the ashes and all fenced in for several months before they kicked him out.
You've referenced legacy, and legacy has been on my mind recently because I just interviewed Shauna Wells. She calls herself a legacy architect. She is brilliant. We had this whole conversation about what legacy truly means outside the traditional form of legacy, which is passing on culture, traditions, norms, wealth. And what I took from that conversation was, at the end of the day, legacy is how we show up in this world, how we conduct ourselves, how do we pass on those values to the future generations. If 100 years from now, someone tells the story of Nancy Wong, what legacy do you hope they will describe you by?
Wow, what a great question. I think I would want them to know that you can do it all. Whatever your passion is, even if you have 2 passions or 3 passions, definitely my life proved that you can do it all. So, when I was growing up, and even after I finished graduate school, it was always that you have to choose one. But I not only became a psychiatric social worker, a medical social worker as well, and went into private practice eventually, but I also became a dancer, which was my passion. And I ended up being able to find a mentor who just gave me everything she knew. So I became a choreographer, a teacher, and I danced in several companies and choreographed for companies, and then became ethnotech eventually.
Nancy, but outside your skills, outside careers that you pursued or are pursuing, what other legacy?
Well, it's like being able to have the courage against rules, to break through those. And I think that was the legacy of my family, although I didn't know it. But the legacy is that have the courage, have the persistence, know yourself. I think I was probably the first one in my entire family to go into therapy, to break all those things that are put on you at birth, really, your culture, what your culture says to you, what your family says to you, what the environment around you says to you, the mainstream population that says you're not as good as we are, you're out, you know, you're not acceptable, you don't look like us, so you need to change something.
Although your family's been around for 5 or 6 generations now, and yet still, right? How ironic is that?
I know. It hasn't ended. It's still here. I talk to my grand nieces, and they're like New York, Connecticut, Philadelphia, Kentucky. I mean, they still, and you talk to other young people, they still have identity problems. I mean, less than it was when I was growing up, where when you watched a movie, it was all white. And if there was an Asian, they were always the bad guy, or they were the subservient gardener or houseboy. It wasn't something to feel really positive about, and that was the whole point. But today, they have like Michelle Yeoh. I mean, they have so many other people to look up to that they can see that we can become a part of it, even though it's a struggle, and it was a struggle for them too.
But going back to breaking rules, what other rules have you broken?
Well, besides going to therapy and coming out, being more whole and not split between being Asian and hating to be Asian, which is huge.
Why did you hate to be Asian?
Because I bought the message that I was not good enough. I was not acceptable.
What changed?
Therapy and being in San Francisco. Being in the Asian arts movement and getting to know that there were other Asians like me who were thriving, and they went through it, but they, I don't know, you know, being raised in Chicago and then going up to school in Wisconsin, always being the only one, the only Asian, but here they were immersed in their Asianness. They were immersed. A lot of them were born and raised in Chinatown. That was a whole other thing that they had to overcome about leaving Chinatown and really confronting that majority cultural mandate. But for me, getting to know somebody that's pretty though comfortable in their Asian skin, that made a difference for me.
Do you think having that immersive experience is essential for kids who are growing up as a minority?
Absolutely. I went finally to China to find my roots. And it was absolutely life-changing.
In what ways?
I remember, because here it didn't feel like any roots, right? Because you were constantly told,
oh my gosh, Nancy, even after five, six generations. Oh, wow.
Yes, yes, yes. You don't get it because it's so around you, you know?
Whose fault is it though? Who do you blame?
Oh, it's white supremacy. It's very clear, white supremacy. So when I was walking just on my own in Shanghai, along a dirt path, I began to tear up and cry because I felt, oh my gosh, this is a path that maybe my own people for thousands of years walked on. That their footprints are somewhere here. There maybe some of their skin fluffed off and it's here. Their hair maybe fell. It's here. I am right on top of all those layers of me.
Wow, that's so profound.
Yeah.
But it's sad though, Nancy, because I keep thinking I am the first generation, right? My kids are second. And to have this conversation with you, even 5, 6 generations removed, you still feel that disorientation. What are we? And by we, I mean society as a whole. What are we doing wrong?
Well, you know, I think it's getting more right. There are far more, there are politicians now who are Asian. CEOs. When my people first came, the only kind of business you could have was a laundry or a restaurant, or you were labor. It's better. And I know that I have many friends who are of Indian descent, and they all had to take dance, the traditional dance. So automatically, at least the women were immersed, and the little boys get to maybe play the drums and the, you know, tabla. But I think that that's what's important, to keep rooted in your mother ethnic group, but also you can't help but be in the American culture because you are in school. You are being educated from their point of view. So that's the danger. When you're only educated from the Western point of view, you adopt their point of view of you.
That is so true. Is there anything that you did not talk about in your book that you wish you did?
Well, you know, it starts off, it's framed with me being in one of the Black Lives Matter marches. And I get to start feeling a little claustrophobic. So I go to the ocean and, you know, and I talk about driving through Chinatown and then J-Town and, you know, Clement Street, Chinatown, and seeing that they're just walking along as if nothing's happening. Don't they know? They need to be marching too. You know, so I go to the ocean and I'm sitting there and getting calmer. And then it starts to rain and storm. And I start to go back in time and see the junk boat. And that's when it goes into the story. So in the end, I go back to, you know, how we need to really stand up. But the one thing I didn't say, which I think is just says it all, is when I was in China, I was on the bus with my father's family and the wife of one of my uncles turns to him and asks a question. And one of my cousins who could speak English I said, why is she looking at me? And he went, ugh, she wants to know, if you're the American relative, why don't I have blonde hair and blue eyes? So that's how far reaching it is that a true American is white. It goes all over the world. I think that's what we are still up against. It's really disheartening and scary.
What gives you hope?
The people, especially in the storytelling world. Oh, we are such humanitarians, mostly left. And we know the power of story and how important it is to tell our stories so that we stay rooted in the reality of who we are, that we are not things to be toyed with, kicked around, that we have. So in my book, I also have pages of all the ways Chinese Americans have contributed to this country. Science, medical, entertainment, social studies, everything.
You know, it's so ironic that we have to make that case, right? We don't ask white Americans what they have contributed. We never do. We let them be entitled. We let them be who they are with all the messiness that they bring. But somehow we have to be the best versions of ourselves, even 5 or 6 generations removed. And I get why you would do that. But at the same time, why do we have to do that all the time?
You know, I don't think there's another country in the world that when white people go visit, they don't give them strife. They don't say, what are you doing in my country? You know, they even get to live in their country. Like Mexico, so many Americans just live there. They rent houses. They build their own houses. They live there.
And that, my friend, is entitlement.
But why in America, it's always like, you can't live here and you can't buy property. You're not allowed. You can't. But we can't give up. Sadia, we cannot give up.
In the end, if you were to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
I say one word is complex. There are good people here for sure. Very good people. Very kind, very generous.
And we need allyship. So if there are allies out there, now is the time to show up.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. And they always have. In my book, I make sure that, you know, that there were allies that helped my family. I mean, there's always someone who had a heart and not just greed.
And who is intentional about how they are showing up in this world and what legacy they intend to pass on. What an incredible conversation, Nancy. Thank you so much. Where can people find your book?
Well, it will be on our website to be ordered. It's going to be going into some libraries and schools. I'd love for it to be required reading in middle school and high school, college. But they can also go to bookstores eventually in the Bay Area. I'm doing some readings in the library on February 2nd in San Francisco, up in the Chinese Center. So that will be the book launch, and so they can buy it there. But I'll also be in different bookstores in end of February and in March. And I'm going to expand that. You know, I'm going to eventually be in Monterey at the museum there, and maybe up in Seattle. So I'm trying to get it out there as much as possible. But definitely go to our website. It's ethnotech.org. ethnohtec.org. It's ethnohtec.org.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Nancy.
Thank you, Sadia, for doing your work. Really. So important. And you're so gracious.
as I said during my conversation with Nancy, legacy has been on my mind ever since I spoke to Shauna Wells. And you know what? Part of my legacy is to unravel these stories. Stories of immigrants who came generations ago, who carved their own space and identity in America. And their generations have lived, survived, and thrived. You know what? These are the stories that we need to share more, and we need to do it as often as possible. I hope you enjoyed this particular interview. If you did, share it with a friend, a family member, a skeptic. Give us a good review, maybe a 5-star review. Why not? Subscribe to our channel on Apple Podcasts. Oh, and by the way, our newest podcast, Lovely, is launching on February 14th. So stay tuned for that. This episode was produced and written by me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Theme music is by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week when I have another guest and an important topic to unravel with all of you. Take care and be kind to others.